Welcome back to another episode of the Lookout Podcast, to a Halloween special with special guest Reen Eustace, who is going to tell us all about a tall tale of a lookout from long ago.
A tall tale from years gone by. The fire season of 1961 had been a long and difficult one on the Bitterroot National Forest. Lightning-caused fires started occurring in late June and starts continued throughout July, August, and September, and even into October. Firefighters from all parts of Montana and the rest of the U.S. had spent time battling the over 130 blazes of all sizes that occurred that historic season. By the end of September, all involved in the firefight were tired. District crews, smoke jumpers, pickup crews, and the few interregional fire crews had all put in weeks of hard work to control these blazes. Fires in the wilderness portion of the forest had been especially difficult to put out due to the trails being the only access into these portions of the forest, precluding the use of engines and other gasoline-powered vehicles. Lots of the hikes into fires were long and were through rough, steep, unroaded mountain country. Finally, in mid-October, much-needed rain and some high-elevation snow arrived in significant enough quantity over enough days that all the fires were finally out by the end of the month. All of the fire lookout tower personnel on Forest had worked a long season too, and now only one lookout remained, the only one left staffed on the entire Bitterroot Forest. The lookout was Elkhorn Mountain, way out in the Idaho portion of the Magruder Ranger District backcountry, on a high, heavily timbered slope above the main Salmon River. The lookout person on Elkhorn, Rick Evans, was in his second season as a lookout, and he had been on duty at his remote Elkhorn outpost since early June. He'd spotted a number of the Magruder District's fires himself. Luckily for Rick, none of the fires were any closer than a mile from his tower, but he had worked long hours giving updates on the fires, helping firefighters locate them, and he had kept those firefighters safe by letting them know in a timely manner, day and night, of changes in fire behavior, if new lightning storms were headed their way, etc. He loved the job and the beautiful location Elkhorn was in, but like everyone else, he was ready for the season to end and to head back down to civilization until the next summer. Rick had happily learned just 4 days prior via a call from the dispatcher at Magruder on the new Motorola battery-powered base radio in the lookout that on October 31st, Halloween, a pack string would arrive at Elkhorn with supplies for next season, and packer Wyatt Thompson would be spending the night and would help Rick close the lookout and winterize it the next morning, and they would then head down toward Magruder. The dispatcher told Rick that an extra saddle horse would be coming up as part of the pack string too, so that he could ride out instead of having to hike the 20-plus miles back to the Magruder Ranger Station. What a treat that would be, not having to walk out. Rick had given the dispatcher his needs list for the next season, which included a number of propane cylinders to power the lookout's new propane cook stove, a new mattress, a new 5-gallon water container, and several new gallon canteens for bringing water from the nearby spring, a 200-foot roll of number 9 telephone wire, a box of phone insulators, several gallons of paint, and some brushes for touching up the exterior of the lookout, and other odds and ends. Elkhorn Lookout still had a telephone line to it that snaked through the forest along the trail all the way from Magruder. It was always good to have spare wire to make repairs as needed. Rick had been taught how to repair a broken phone line during guard school his first season. This was the first year that the battery-powered radio had been used at the lookout. It had worked well, but the forest wasn't ready yet to give up the phone line and rely entirely on the new radio. Veteran packer Wyatt had been packing for the Forest Service in the Magruder country for 20 years. He received the order of lookout needs from the dispatcher and had gathered everything up at the station's barn to load onto his trusty mules. It was a crisp last day of October morning when Wyatt and his horse, his mules loaded with supplies, and the horse for Rick were ready to head out just after dawn light. With a gentle let's go, they headed up along the Selway River into the forest on the start of their journey to Elkhorn. Wyatt had made this trip to Elkhorn dozens of times, but today felt different. A lingering sense of unease settled in the pit of his stomach. He couldn't explain the feeling he had. It was just there. This was a beautiful blue sky day, almost no clouds at all, but the morning air had a chill to it. As they climbed higher, the air grew cooler and thinner. Wyatt paused late afternoon at the last known water source, letting the horses and mules drink and rest. He scanned the surrounding peaks and noticed some fog starting to develop, and he sensed a change in the weather. At 16:30, the brand new two-way radio that Wyatt took with him to try out for the first time crackled to life. "Wyatt, this is Rick at Elkhorn. Estimated time of arrival?" Wyatt replied, "About 2 more hours, Rick, making good time. I'm at the last water source along the trail right now." The pack string continued upward, disappearing into the swirling mist. Wyatt led the way, his eyes fixed on the trail ahead. But as the mist cleared, Wyatt had vanished. At 19:30, an hour past Wyatt's planned arrival at the lookout, Rick began to worry. He scanned the direction the pack string would arrive from for the familiar sight of it coming up the trail. It was now almost dark, and mist was starting to swirl at the lookout, too. The radio remained silent. Rick called Wyatt on the radio again to check in, but received no reply. At 19:50, Rick called dispatch at Magruder to let the dispatcher know about Wyatt's earlier message about his location and planned arrival time, and that he had not arrived and had not answered a radio call checking on him. Since it was now completely dark, dispatch told Rick to keep trying to reach Wyatt on the radio. They wouldn't be able to send out a search party for him till daylight tomorrow if he hadn't showed up. Rick tried to reach Wyatt several more times before midnight, at around 3 that next morning, and at 0600. Dispatch heard Rick's 0600 call and checked in with him. They told Rick that a search party would be heading up that way shortly from Magruder. The search party traced Wyatt's route up toward Elkhorn. It was easy to see the tracks of the mules and horses on the trail. They passed the last water source where Wyatt had talked to Rick on the radio. As they continued on up, they found an empty trail, devoid of any sign, no tracks, human or animal, no indication of a struggle or any sort of disturbance. The only clue was Wyatt's two-way radio on the ground in the middle of the trail. As one of the men dismounted and reached out to pick up the radio, it suddenly crackled to life, saying, "About 2 more hours, Rick. About 2 more hours. This really frightened the search party, but they continued on up to the lookout, still finding no tracks or any sign of the missing packer. Once all were safely back at the Magruder Ranger Station with Rick, and they were discussing this mysterious happening as they sat around a crackling campfire, speculation drifted to thoughts of mysterious mountain energies, ancient Native American spirits, cursed trails. Nothing was ever heard of Wyatt or his pack string ever again. Some say that on quiet mountain nights, and especially on All Hallows' Eve, the sound of Wyatt's pack string echoes through the mist, a haunting reminder of the mysterious forces that lurk within the Bitterroot Mountains.
That's right. Yeah, man.
Wow.
That's a good one, Reed.
Man. This was titled The Vanishing Pack String of Elkhorn Mountain. Names were changed, of course, to protect the innocent.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, man. That's a great story, my friend. And for listeners, me and Reen are both fans of Washington Irving, right? And his Sleepy Hollow tale. So we kind of got to brainstorming on this project. And we're like, man, I want to do a Halloween project. And then, you know, this kind of came up, and I was on actually vacation when you called me and had the story. I was like, yeah, man, let's do that.
There are some cool kind of Halloween themed things, like the Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
That's what
and
it's, yeah.
The Adventures of Ichabod Crane. And I think back in the old 78 RPM record days, Bing Crosby, I believe, narrated both of those programs.
Yeah, just watch it with my kiddos. Well, I watched it as a kid myself, but yeah, the Bing Crosby narrated cartoon of Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
The cartoon version, yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
If folks for listening, folks who are listening, if you haven't seen it, I think you can find it on like Disney Plus, like on the app.
But, and I think you might even be able to just YouTube the titles and they'll show up also.
Yeah, totally. And I think it's like Adventures of Mr. Frog and Ichabod Crane or something. It's got an odd title. It took me a while to find it because I was looking for Legend of Sleepy Hollow, you know?
Yeah.
And you could probably find it just by searching that too. But, man, I love this time of year. You know, for us, it's a bit of a holiday. Like, I mean, it's a holiday for everybody. Halloween is, but like the fall, because us, you know, being fire folks, it's a break, like you said in the story. You
things
know,
are finally starting to wind down, actually on the Bitterroot.
Yeah.
No lookouts are up now. Sophie on Teepee Point was the last one, and she came down, I believe, last Saturday.
Man, she's putting up some great photos. So folks are looking for some cool lookout photos. Try to find her on Instagram because she's got some good ones.
Yeah.
Man, like the one where she got the dusting of snow. It was a little bit more than a dusting just a couple days ago. That was awesome.
Yeah. Some good stuff.
Yeah, just on top of the world views that not too many folks get access to. So
I think, you know, because of the way the season turned out and the fact that after the fires were pretty much out, I think some of the wilderness fires are still percolating around, but they've gotten enough moisture now that they're, at least on our forest, they're not going to really go anywhere. Yeah. And as soon as this next moisture arrives, which sounds like it could be fairly substantial, probably put an end to that. But it stayed dry long enough, you know, and I was out of West Fork toward the end of last week, putting the last of the lookout supplies away in their storage areas at the station. The crew was able to go out and prep for some burning, but they had not been able to do anything, really, just because it was too dry.
Yeah, too dry and hot for you, and you know, prescribed fire right now. And it's not like we have a weather event that is going to be huge that you can bet on either, you know? Like, you put fire on the ground right now, typically you got a big cell that's coming and it's, you know,
asking for trouble.
Yeah, right now if you did, for sure, you know? So,
yeah,
hopefully get some good fire on the ground to help, you know, prevent the bad ones next year.
Normally, by this time of year, you can start burning.
Yeah.
But not this time.
No. Yeah, it's kind of strange. Even, you know, some of the folks who are getting burned out around their, you know, on their dishes and stuff that they're trying to do this fall, you know, and haven't been able to get after it.
Right,
even those small ones.
I know West Fork has a lot of pile units to burn all over the place, but same thing. A lot of them are on steep slopes, you know, and it's just not the time until the snow's going to stick around and stay that you can deal with that.
Yeah, totally. Because, we had, I think it was around this time of year, you know, I mean, that's a typical burning time, but it was very, you know, that Halloween, like, you know, the trees were changing in the shorter days, you know, and the kind of different, more like amber light you get from the fall. And we were burning piles up the rattlesnake in there in Missoula. And we even had some snow and it rained right as we were burning. And then it rained harder as we were getting the piles burned. And we're just, you know, stirring the heavies and getting everything to consume a little better and kind of babysit it until the end of the day. And man, even that, you know, it was a drier year. I think that was 17, you know, we had the little peak fire.
Yeah.
And like that, unfortunately, people kept calling that in because it just kept skunking around. It wasn't really going anywhere, but still, it wouldn't.
Right. Just wouldn't go out.
Yeah. It wouldn't go to bed. So,
yeah. Well, I know just this last week, I mean, we were still having horrible smoke conditions here in the valley.
Yeah.
I mean, I live down 3 miles south of Darby, and it was kind of bad down there, but it was really bad, as most folks that live in the Hamilton, Corvallis, and maybe up toward your area here outside of Stevensville. It was really smoky. And one morning, I believe I heard on the radio, if I heard it correctly, that the day before, so this would have been like maybe last Wednesday or somewhere in there, that Hamilton had, on that particular day, the worst air quality in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Because of all the smoke.
Yeah, it was getting pretty bad there. And I noticed it more that I'm not fighting fire anymore. I noticed the, direct fighting fire anymore on the line, I guess. I'm not on the line anymore.
Right.
I don't know if I just was like clogged sinus the whole time and so I just got used to it, or if I'm just really sensitive to smoke now that I don't, fight direct fire anymore.
Yeah, I think it's true.
It was bothering me last week pretty bad, and I'm not used to that. Usually it's whatever,
Yeah, I remember, in some of the really horrible conditions, like on the Klamath in 87, when the inversion was so thick that literally hundreds of firefighters got strep throat. Oh. And some people, actually, it was really cold down under the inversion at night and early in the morning. But then when it had break about 10 a.m., the fires would just rip up higher, and a lot of the smoke would blow out, but it would settle back in at night. Yeah. And lots of people got kind of walking pneumonia conditions, and all of us were so hoarse that we could hardly talk. I mean, you noticed it, but you didn't, because everybody had that going on at the same time. All the firefighters were there.
Yeah.
And didn't really notice it until after we'd been down there for about 3 weeks living in those conditions. And we finally flew back home and landed in Missoula and got out of the plane. And it was beautiful blue sky, and there was no smoke here at all, And then I remember the next day going into Hamilton to get some errands done, and I ran into a couple of friends that I'd worked with that weren't firefighters, and they were like, "What happened to your voice?" And it's like, "What? Oh, yeah, it is. Yeah, it was so real squeaky and everything,
Oh, yeah.
I couldn't talk without my voice cracking like that and stuff." And it's like, wow, it really was bad.
I was kind of wondering if it had changed my voice a little bit, like if none of us, if like me and you didn't fight fire, if we'd have like little different voices, because, like smokers, their voices get changed after a while. My mom was a smoker, and when I was a kid, she wasn't.
I never was, but man, I smoked a lot of, I sucked in a lot of smoke. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, so that's
no question about it.
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering, if it kind of changed a lot of us who've sucked so much smoke, fighting fire. Because my mom, it didn't seem like it took that long. Like, I remember she lived in Alabama, so I wouldn't see her that much. Over the phone, I didn't notice as much, but then when I saw her in person, I was like, holy cow, like, smoker voice, And maybe she was just hitting them hard or something, and so it changed her voice, but it didn't seem like it took that long. And
We all, as we left, and I know that the entire Bitterroot Hotshot crew got this, and I think all the others' crews did too. We got authorization from the fire overhead team, a medical form, to actually go in to our family doctors in Hamilton or wherever we were all from, and get checked. And we were told to hang on to those pieces of paper in case sometime way down the line you develop some sort of a throat issue or something that conceivably, could be traced back to that evil smoke.
Yeah.
And
especially 3 weeks.
I never had to use it, but I've still got it. I kept it.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah. I got told by a couple folks, one fellow who, like, it was lucky because he was tough as nails, and he was like, "Man, every time anything happens to me on the fire line, like, even if it's nothing bad, like, you fill out a CA1, it doesn't matter for anything, but you have the paper trail if it does down the road, because most of the stuff, I mean, even like Agent Orange for, Vietnam veterans,
right?
It wasn't like that year or the next month or that day. It was down the road,
down the line of ways. Yeah.
Yeah. So for anyone else, for the folks listening, if you have something like you just explained, 3 weeks in the smoke, or even just, over the one bad night, like where your eyes are puffing, you get that headache, and
yep.
I mean, fill out the CA1, it doesn't hurt anything,
It's hard to believe some of the stuff we did, Oof. Now that you look back on it and everything, it's just part of the job,
this
and
it
wasn't pleasant, but it's what you did.
Yeah.
But man, it was pretty bad at times.
Especially sleeping. That's what I think about a lot, is like that kind of, cause like when you're awake, you're sucking it, but you're in increments, like you'll dive in to cut a tree, or if you're burning, you know, you're holding and you dive in to like kind of help, you know, check the line, and then you pop back out to get some fresh air and check the green. And but like when you're sleeping in it, you're sucking in all night, and that's when my eyes would get puffy and everyone looked like they aged overnight, like 10 years, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
I had that in Eastern Montana, which is crazy because there wasn't any mountains out there, you know, but it was still like a crazy inversion like yours, and just sat on us for, we only had about maybe a week of it. But I remember feeling like hell.
It's long enough.
It is, man. And it takes a while to recover from it.
Yeah. So do you ever remember doing any really fun things on Halloween when you were a kid?
Oh, yeah. I'm glad you brought that up. Man, when I was really little, I'm still living in Illinois, and all the hardwoods, you know, so tons of leaf litter. So around my nana's neighborhood, all the neighbors, and my nana and Cleo, would rake their leaves into the ditch, and they burn them off in the ditch. And so, like, we'd be ripping around the neighborhood on our bikes. And it was an older neighborhood, like older, like brick homes and stuff, you know, like everything is probably built like a lot of them were built in like the 50s, I would say. So this cool old neighborhood where, you know, the yards are bigger, so it's not like everything's smushed in, and there's a lot of trees, and it just kind of set the scene for the fall. And like, you know, that was kind of like a warm up to trick or treating. And then, we'd always go trick or treat her neighborhood too, cause she, you know, had a smaller neighborhood too when we were little, and she made her costumes a lot. And so those are cool memories. And, but one of my favorite nights, probably the last night I was in, Illinois, cause it was at that age where like everyone's aging out to, trick or treat, cause they're getting too cool for it or whatever. And like bullies were going around stealing candy. So, me and one of my best buddies at the time, we were, you know, fighting those guys all night and trick or treating. And it was just cool. Like a battle. Like we weren't like taking it personally, but every time they saw us, they'd try to chase us down on their bikes. And one of them had like a golf cart. So like we were dodging that all night. And then we went and dumped all of our candy off at my dad's house, and then like kept our bags and filled them with like rocks or something. And then they got close, we like just, you know, took off running, like dropped our bags, and they were like stopped, you know, did the old decoy, and they went for our bags, and they were even more mad because no candy, just rocks. So just like, you know, those are kind of like just fun little games. And
yeah,
I don't know if that happens much anymore. Like people used to like TP houses just as a, you know, as a prank.
Yeah when I was little, of course, I grew up in San Diego, so yeah. We were in the city, you know, and we had favorite neighborhoods. You know, when we were real little, our folks would take us around in tow, you know, as they'd want us wandering around by ourselves. But then we got a little bit older, the folks would be around, but not right with us. And we'd go up and down people's blocks. And, you know, the word would always get out that a certain neighborhood, you know,
had the best candy
yes. or whatever. So we'd try and hit those places and, you know, get all this cool candy and everything. And then as we got older, we didn't live too far from San Diego State, and a lot of those areas around the perimeter of the university and stuff, they were fun to go to. Even, you know, even as high school kids, we'd go do that sometimes, you know. And
yeah.
People would be like, aren't you a little bit old to be doing this? And it's like, sir, you're never too old for candy.
Yeah, totally. You know, one of my best buddies, he's on the Billings Fire Department, and he's a paramedic, and he's doing like some awesome search and rescue stuff with the military right now. And just, you know, great guy. But me and him are both late bloomers, so I think we trick or treated up until like sophomore year of high school, and no one noticed, you know, like because we just still look like babies. But like you said, it's fun, you know. And
yeah.
Man, we had some cold Halloweens though up here. Like, I think almost every, I don't know about every, but like felt like every Halloween we're getting snowed on. And so you were really moving quick from house to house, you know?
I remember the first year we lived here, that fall in 74, my cousin's kids were 8 and 4, turned 4. Little girl was 4, Randy was 8. And we came into Hamilton. And it was really cool because it had been a really spectacular leaf year, and there'd been wind, you know, and there were just piles of leaves everywhere to jump in for the kids and all that stuff, you know, and walk around Hamilton. People were really cool, you know, really good about giving out candy and other things like that. It was really neat.
Yeah, it's so cool. And you get like that sometimes the weather when it's perfect, when you get the leaves and the smell of the leaves and maybe a little smoke in the air from whoever. And
fireplaces in town and everything, yep.
Yeah, so you get that little bit of smoke. And it really helps set the scene for Halloween. And you talking about the leaves reminds me of another great Halloween special, the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
The Peanuts.
Yep.
Oh, man, what a great cartoon that is.
Yeah, that was a good one. I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah.
A friend of mine lives in a neighborhood in San Diego, which just happens to be one of those ones that are still really popular because the people that live there give out good candy. And my friend told me that he's had as many as 100 or 150 kids come by and keep track of them.
How awesome.
Yeah.
Man, I would love that.
So he'd stock up, you know, he knew it was going to be like that because that's how it was in his neighborhood. So ahead of time, he'd go to Costco and he'd get the big bags of, you know, small, you know, kinds of candy bars and things like that so that he had plenty for them.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. I love seeing the costumes. We go trick-or-treat with some of my friends in town, Buck Lunick and his wife in Stevensville here. So they're like the base camp in Stevensville, and so we'll go hang out with them. And man, his wife cooks awesome food. His wife Emma, and she does pizza, and then she loves giving out candy. And Buck and my other friend Richmond always dress up too, and so we all dress up, and then we'll take the kids parading around, and then we'll come back, and it's just so cool to see all the costumes. That's one of my favorite parts now as an adult. It's just getting to see everyone dressed up, you know, and the family of costumes and stuff, you know.
Yeah, I remember, you know, those years between 85 and 95 when I was on the Hot Shot crew, we'd sometimes be gone during those time periods of when Halloween fell.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and I can remember a couple of big camps and catering services, primarily down in Southern Cal, where the catering service, you know, would have all kinds of orange and black Halloween, you know, like
streamers.
Yeah, that fake spider web stuff and everything all around the where the food area was and stuff like that.
Oh, that's cool,
man.
Yeah,
it was pretty cool.
I love it, man. Such a great time of year.
And they'd even sometimes, you know, wear the people that serve the food would wear these crazy masks and stuff like that.
Oh, really? Oh, that is cool, man.
It was cool.
Yeah, I love when people get in the spirit because, like, man, I think someone told me, I'm gonna butcher this, but one of my good friends who it's always the people that I don't expect, and he's like, you take every opportunity to dress up and have a good time because there's not that many. And he's like, how often do you get to dress up? How often do you get to go celebrate something and just have fun? He's
like, right.
You know, if you think just about Halloween, is most people dress up for it's once a year.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
and you only get so many of those, so enjoy it to the fullest.
Get all kinds of cool loot.
Yeah, cool little pranks and, you know, haunted houses and all the fun stuff that comes with that.
Yeah, that's right. I'd forgotten there were some of the like grammar schools and junior high schools would have like a haunted house deal.
Oh, really?
That went through the halls, you know, and some of the rooms would have things that would pop out, you know, and all this stuff.
Man, that's so cool. Yeah, when I was really little, in Illinois, we were at this Grass Lake Middle School, and it was so cool because it was a K-8, so everybody dressed up, you know, even the 8th graders, you know, and even though they seemed like full-grown adults when I was there as a kid, and we'd have Halloween parties, but usually at the second half of the day, I think, but in the morning, they'd start like kindergarten, and they parade each class through, so everybody got to see everybody's costume, the whole
costumes,
school.
Yeah, that's cool.
It was so cool, man, like, it's good to take time and enjoy those moments, you know, like,
yeah,
people don't forget, like, I still remember that day, you know,
yeah.
Those days.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, oh, yeah, some of my favorite. The Great Pumpkin thing, my great-grandpa and my Nana papier-mâché'd, and I gotta ask my uncle to be sure, but I'm pretty sure that's what they were doing, was like going for the Great Pumpkin theme. But they papier-mâché these big heads, and they put them on, and so when trick-or-treaters would come, they'd answer the door with, like, a big Snoopy head and a big, you know, pumpkin jack-o'-lantern head. And that pumpkin was, I mean, even that Snoopy was pretty freaky for kids. So, like, there was a lot of kids that were just screaming,
you know,
in the doors open. Yeah, it wasn't meant to be scary, but they were not as friendly-looking as I think my Nana thought it was going to be.
It's kind of scary, but most kids, you know, they understand what Halloween's about, and it's okay to be scary, but, you know, they're not like really terrified or anything.
No, totally just like, oh no, didn't expect this. And you know, adults looking like giants, especially with the big heads.
Yeah.
There was a house, and I almost forgot about this, but there was a house that was near my dad's place in Illinois, and the garage, you had to like walk past the garage to get to the main house. You know, it was like a garage in the front and then a house, but there was like a walkway. And they like all decorated and stuff, and it was playing some just freaky like music and screams and like banging, and then like there'd be this big scream, and they'd throw a body out of the, I wouldn't say off the roof, and like it would, and it was on a rope, and they'd just drag it back up. But when the trick-or-treaters were coming, they'd throw it like right in front of you, and you're like, oh my God.
Or like a skeleton or something that would do that.
They had like a dummy that they were throwing off the roof, and it was so dark you like couldn't tell the difference. You're like, oh man, like, just scare the pants off you. But fun, right? Like you'd run away and then you'd come back. You know?
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, that kind of stuff's awesome. I don't know if people are really going all out as much as they used to. You know?
I don't know, really.
Yeah, I don't really hear too many people like TPing anybody's houses anymore or anything like that.
It's usually pretty quiet down my place because there aren't too many lights down there or anything, yeah. You know, and it's not a real popular place for kids to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And,
yeah, I know they go on some of the streets in Darby, you know, but nothing like probably Hamilton, because Hamilton was good way back when, probably still is.
Yeah, totally. And there's like more routes and stuff. And there's like the trunk or treat thing, which is kind of cool. Like people go to like the parking lot and they have, you know, candy in their trunks and to, you know, have like a better gathering spot. And then there's what was I thinking of the other one? I've heard of like some camping things, like my wife's cousin goes and does like a trick-or-treat camping thing. So they all go to this campground and like a bunch of people, and you know, have like a little camp, you know, have their camper set up for trick-or-treating, and the kids get all dressed up and go like camper to camper, and it's in the campground. It sounds pretty cool, you know.
Huh, that's cool.
Yeah, I like the idea of that, man. I can't get this thermostat right. Do you want to try bumping it up and see if it kicks back on? You just gotta turn it clockwise, like to the right there. Yeah. Well, did you feel a click?
I couldn't really hear it with the headphones. Yeah. I think it did.
All right. Yeah, we'll see if it comes back on.
We'll know in a minute here.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. Like, I don't know. I haven't used it that much. Like, I used it last year for hunting season, and it did really good. And we kept it on low, and it was nice and warm. I mean, it was getting really cold. It was down to the teens, if not colder.
Oh, night, yeah, I bet.
North of Whitehall there. And then, I haven't really used it much since. So I still haven't built trust on it.
Nice to be in the Airstream instead of out in a tent.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that's, I was talking to somebody about that today at work or the other day. It's like, you know, being in family, you know, having a family in fires, like a lot of times you're gone all summer, and then the first thing your family wants to do is go camping. You're like, oh God, just lived in a tent all summer. So yeah, I'm going over the tent life, but I still like camping a lot.
Yeah.
So just not on the ground as much if I can avoid it.
When you do it all the time, though, it's, you know, it kind of loses a little bit of its luster for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the same camping on a fire as it would be going, you know, camping with your family or something like that, for sure.
Yeah, totally. I'm still trying to get back into like a backpacker mode. And my kids are, you know, young, so once they get a little older, try to get into some more backpacking trips and stuff. So that'll be the future plan. I had a question for you. I think we talked about this before, but do you think Magruder Ranger Station is haunted?
I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, it's black in there, man. You hear stories like...
It is kind of out there in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of native, you know, traveling between there, and packers and stuff is... You know,
it's a lot of spooky critters out in the woods.
Yeah, and that is out there. Holy cow. Yeah, you know, man, so yeah, who knows, right?
I mean,
Magruder Massacre is not far from there. And
No. Yeah, it's an out-of-the-way place, but a beautiful one.
It is, yeah. I kind of hope it's haunted.
Those last couple of times I went out there delivering food to Magruder Crossing. Magruder Crossing is where the bridge over the Selway is, that a driving bridge that goes further out the Elk City Road, actually all the way to Elk City.
Oh, just down from the
Range Station, yeah. And the river, you know, that last time I was out there, it was maybe a couple weeks ago now, and man, the river was really low.
Yeah, I've been noticing that too.
Hadn't been a lot of water, a lot of rain or anything for a long time.
Yeah.
And it was low.
That's kind of noticing that
there
too.
There were portions where I think you would have had trouble even kayaking, you know. until probably a ways after where the Whitecap comes in, because it pumps a lot of water. But Whitecap is right there by Paradise.
Oh yeah.
And then further downriver, I know when I got to do that float trip in 2014, we weren't too far downriver from Paradise, and the gal who was in charge of our float trip, Lisa, was the wilderness, the river ranger.
Oh yeah.
At that point in time on the Selway, and you know the water's crystal clear. This was like in late July. It's crystal clear, and you could see that the bottom was maybe only a foot under the rafts, you know, and really close. And she said that it was just about the time of year where in this one stretch of maybe a couple of hundred yards, you might have to actually get out of the rafts and kind of push them through that area because they'd catch on rocks on the bottom and stuff like that. We didn't have to. Like I say, it probably stayed about a foot deep underneath the footprint of the raft, you know, that was down in the water. But, and I think she said we found out later from her that we were the last group that went through with rafts that didn't have to get out. So
it makes for a long day if you have to push a lot. I've been there on the Dearborn River.
Yeah.
But it's been a few, because 2 years ago, I want to say, I think it's 2 years ago now, I pulled that permit for the Smith River, and it was the second week in July. And, by the time that came around, I had friends that had floated just like a week or two before me, my friend Garrett and Tyler Rowe. And they said it was a little bony, but it didn't sound like it was going to be too bad. But just like drought hit pretty hard over in that country, and so all the ranchers had to start turn up the irrigation in the fields, and, you know, it just dried it up. So
I know down part of the time, you know, I made a number of driving trips down to the end of the road on the main Salmon River at Corn Creek, which is where one of the last put-ins, well, actually it is the last put-in before you're in the completely unroaded part of the main Salmon River.
Yeah.
And toward the end there, the jet boatman that would take our guys and the food and stuff down to Lance Bar where they were working, he said that they had to change the pattern of where they went in the river with the jet boats because, you know, the areas they'd been able to go in even a few weeks earlier were so low that you would actually hit a lot of rocks if you didn't follow the main deepest part of the river. And those guys do that so much, they know exactly where the main deepest parts of the river are, especially if they're doing it every day or every other day.
So skilled, man.
Yeah. It's a big river compared to the Selway.
Yeah.
But even it, you know, in a kind of a drought year like a lot of this was, gets pretty low in places.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Man, boatman's name wasn't Wyatt, was it?
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah.
Yep.
I think that, something about a boatman. Boatman would be kind of another good story, I think. That's what kind of popped in my head. I was just like picturing like this ominous like boatman coming up to give you a ride. Like, Don't go with that guy.
Yep.
Well, thanks, Reena. I appreciate you coming, man. I won't keep you too late. And if, you know.
Yeah, no, it's good to celebrate Halloween a little bit early.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Happy Halloween.
Yeah, same to you. So what number podcast is this, you know?
This is going to be number 70.
70?
Yeah, wow. 70. So yeah, we're chugging along. I talked to a few folks that were just, you know, kind of numbers folks, like my friend Mark Troxel, and he was saying, he's like, you know, to keep pushing to get 100 episodes. He's like, then you have like some good numbers to, you know, for algorithms and stuff to pick up more episodes, you know, and you know, I'm getting traction every episode, so it's doing all right. And then, you know, 100 just, you know, seems to hit the algorithm a little better or something, or you have better odds, you know, 100 episodes. And
for sure. Well, congrats on number 70. I'm proud to be here for it.
Oh, thank you so much for coming, man. I appreciate you. It's been great. Every episode's been awesome. And a little teaser for one of the next ones, and you know, it's hard to say because there's always something that comes up, and you've got a vast history and fire and adventure, but one that me and Reen have been talking about for a while is it the 88 fires of Yellowstone.
That
was a good adventure. I was just talking to Mr. Nyhart about that just the other day because I didn't realize he was on the crew too. Kevin, yeah.
Yeah, he was there with us for sure. Yeah, he remembers it for sure. But yeah, you and I talk about it every once in a while.
Yeah, we got to talk a little bit about it and you know, getting his story on and stuff. So
I don't think any of the probably, well, thousands and thousands of firefighters that were there over the course of that whole saga will forget it.
No. You know,
especially mainly just because of where it was. I mean, yeah, there was some incredible fire behavior, you know, and lots of things like that. But, you know, just those animals that are all over the place. And
yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Oh, really amazing. I mean, like, I started my career in 2008, so 20 years later, right? And even folks that I was running into that were on whatever crew came from wherever, like my first fire assignment with the engine, I was in the middle of nowhere on the Navajo reservation, I think it was. There was a guy who was like, "Hey man, I'll go with you, I'll fight some fire." And he's wearing Nomex. And I was like, you know, I just like, "Hey man, yeah, but we don't do it like that anymore. Like they used to, you just kind of pick people up." But I was like, "What's the last fire you're on?" He's like, "88 Yellowstone." I was like, "Geez, man, it's been a minute then." But you know, like, my first couple of years, I feel like I've run into a lot of folks who, you know, that was their kind of shared moment, because you said like thousands of firefighters on that sucker.
Yeah, and there were some other giant fires that summer too. I remember there was one up northern Montana that I think it was a Canyon Creek fire was the name of it,
oh,
I believe, and it made a massive, you know, like 50-mile run one night way in from the mountains all the way out onto the prairie.
Oh, geez.
Not in the park, obviously, but it was, you know, a Montana fire. And there were a lot of fire behavior studies done at the end of that season because, you know, they changed the fire behavior models and stuff because those fires were just exceeding all the predictions, and the predictions weren't accurate for what were going to happen.
Yeah,
so they changed the way they collected data and stuff like that. I don't really understand all of it, but
yeah, no,
yeah,
yeah, but you actually got to get out to the fire lab, and I believe it's Sarah Brown and Dan, blanking on Dan's last name right now, but I talked to them about Mount Gulch, and then like you said, some of these other bigger fires that kind of changed with how things are getting done, and how, you know, some of the research that they're doing on it, and so I got to get over to the fire lab, actually. That just reminded me, I got to go over there and bug those guys and get a tour. And
yeah.
And I think Dan's going to come on and talk a little shop about what goes on with the fire lab.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one. So that's another little teaser.
They do good work up there, that's for sure.
Yeah, really cool. And they got, was it the fire, like burn box tunnel thing? Jeez. What's his name? Talked about in his book. Norm MacLean talked about in his book with
you mean about Pulaski's tunnel or
no, like the actual like testing fire tunnel that test like fuels in like burn chamber. I think that's probably what it's called. I don't know why I couldn't come up with that, but like the burn chamber, and then how Gisborne had a little tiny burn chamber in the federal building way back when, and so it's kind of cool history. Like, I mean, he was doing that stuff.
Yeah, a lot of the history and study of fires happened here.
Yeah, which is so cool. Yeah, just down the road from where we're at right now.
Yeah,
but yeah, thanks again, Reen. So that's a little teaser for the next one is Yellowstone, and then a fire lab coming up. Yeah, can't wait, man. Looking forward. Thanks again, and thanks everybody for tuning in, and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween.